Hello there, welcome to the Paramount Podcast. I'm Robin Ince, joined by my normal sidekick, seems very demeaning, Josie Long, except we're not joined by her because she's been at Weight Watchers. And she said that we had to start slightly late because she'd be at Weight Watchers, but unfortunately Weight Watchers has taken longer, as you imagine. We'll find the results out. So, I mean, what a...
Is that really where she's been?
Yeah, she really has been to Weight Watchers. She's very much in... I think it's more that she's intrigued by the notion of powdered soups, which, you know, because I think that's what it's based around, isn't it?
Well, I'm sad to say that's one area of life that I'm rather ignorant of.
Well, I think
the whole culture of weight watching.
I think it's not dissimilar to Scientology. I think they lure
I think it's
you
similar,
in.
A similar thing. That's how Cruise got started, I think, because he was huge. Not only was he short, but he was 24 stone. Went along there, and they said it's powdered soup, and you have to give over 95% of your wages and lie prostrate on the floor screaming to an omnipresent force. So I heard anyway. My son, being 11, he loves watching films. I'm watching all these sort of... I'm showing him loads of these classic films. And I showed him The Wicker Man a little while ago. And he sussed it. He sussed it brilliantly because he was going, the thing is, Dad, Edward Woodward, he's complaining... Well, he didn't say Edward Woodward. He said, he's not that sharp. But he said, you know, that man was that man was complaining about the pagans, but his religion's just as nutty, wasn't it, Dad? Which I thought was brilliant, but not as brilliant as the fact that I had, because I'm not with my the mother of the kids, we're apart. So this was over Christmas, and they were with me for about a week, my kids, and then when I took them back to their mum. I've got two kids, like my son and then Eloise, which is his little sister, who's seven. And I took them back to their mum, and she said, well, what have you been doing all over Christmas? And my son said, first thing he said, I saw The Wicker Man. She's gone nuts. She's absolutely nuts. What the hell are you doing him? Showing him a film like that? You should have asked me first. That's disgraceful, typical. Oh, blimey, here we go. And just as it calmed down, just in the, with perfect timing, my boy said, oh, don't worry, Mum. Eloise didn't see it. She went to bed straight after The Exorcist. Brilliant. I was so proud. Caused absolute furore, of course.
See, I was allowed to, because I was always a big fan of horror films. I think a lot of the kind of generation of late 30-somethings were, because BBC Two used to have the fantastic horror double bill season, which would, I don't know when it started, but first one would be Black and White, first one would be Lon Chaney or Boris Karloff, one of the old Universal horrors, and then the right. Second one would be something gaudy in colour, which you don't know where it would. I think there was one that starred Tom Selleck, which it turns out in hindsight wasn't very good. My critical judgment at the age of 9 was frankly shot, and it's moulded me into... I've actually learnt my left and my right from horror books, because I bought my first horror book after my 8th birthday. I think it was The Pictorial History of Horror Movies by Alan Frank, and I never could remember my left and right, but once it said left Boris Karloff in the Tower of London, right Bela Lugosi in The White Zombie, I'd go, well, I know that's Bela Lugosi. So I knew who Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff were before I knew my left and my right. I remember all those things, and now it annoys me slightly, even though I've got Boris Karloff posters framed in my house, I'm still slightly annoyed that as I'm trying to discover more about cosmology, I can't remember that, but I can remember most of his films in chronological order, and which of the Mr. Wong films are particularly disappointing. And that's Josie Long. We're just on Josie Long. We're on the Mr. Wong films with Boris Karloff at the moment.
And we've already been discussing you for some length.
I'm very upset.
We have briefly talked about...
Oh, please don't.
No. We briefly talked about Weight Watchers. That was all. We were saying, is Weight Watchers the same as Scientology? Have you
and
actually been brought into a sachet soup-based cult?
Well, they say, oh, you're hungry? Why not have some of our snacks? And you're like, because they're £7 is why.
Well, it's just, that is the same as Scientology, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, so if you went in there and said, do I need... If they had a thing saying, are you overweight, you know, like the Scientology thing, and you went in there and they give you tests, they wouldn't say, no, you're, you know, you could... Naomi Campbell could go in there. Well, I think you could do with a little bit of sachet soup.
The other night I ended up doing a thing about the Oscars, and the first bit of it was about fashion, which, as you... clearly know I have no interest in. And it actually makes me quite annoyed when someone goes, oh, Tilda Swinton, what does she think she looks like? She looks quite nice. She's a really good actress. I don't see why she should be all glammed up and wearing, you know, kind of cleavage right. makeup or whatever.
She's not at a fashion awards.
No.
She's
and the woman who was doing it, she went, and I mean, in many ways, I think Halle Berry is the epitome of, and I loved it, and I didn't pick up on it, but I really wanted to. I thought, there you are. And you've, and as someone's commented afterwards, she'd noticed the word, she's read the word, but she's never heard it spoken. So undoubtedly, I would say Mark Steele is the epitome.
Who said the epitome?
This fashion expert. She knew a lot more about the different descriptions of hemlines than I did, though.
Yeah, less about four syllable words.
Yeah,
and how they should be pronounced.
I always say that thing that, because I know that you, Mark, have had to do a lot of research in the past for some of your shows on BBC Four, where you looked at, you know, Darwin and did you do Marx as well? At one
yeah,
point?
Marx. Yeah,
yeah. And did you ever get annoyed with those books that they're vaguely intellectual books? They're books that are meant for people like us who aren't necessarily tremendously versed. You know, we don't spend all our life hiding in the British Library, you know, leaping out professors with beards and trying to shock their pipes out of their mouths, but you'll read about, and they have to still put something in Latin and not translate it.
Yeah,
because they have to remind you that, go, do you know what, I am still cleverer than you. Yeah. I know I've written an easy
book. Well, it goes back
book.
To, you know, this was the way that these books were written up until, well, Tom Paine was quite a landmark in a way with this, because that's one of the reasons the establishment hated Tom Paine's writing in the 1790s, that were political pamphlets in support of the French Revolution, in support of democracy in Britain. And they hated it, not just because of the content, but because it was written in a language that most people could understand. And they absolutely hated it. And Edmund Burke, who was this sort of very conservative politician at the time, wrote utter bile about it and said, you know, there's not even any of the, none of it's in Greek and things like that. Because he would sort of write a rejoinder and it would suddenly have a big load of Greek or something in the middle of it. Pompous fuckers, aren't they? But there's no better. When I did that research, or as such as it was, the pomposity of these fuckers. Where shall I start with this? Well, this is like this is one of them stories that every time I tell it, I think, oh, I'm exaggerating this for comic effect, and I have to remind myself, and I'm glad that there was one or two other people there as well. So, the Darwin programme I did, right, now, we had to go and have the scripts checked by an academic for one reason or another, for factual errors. Now, given that, you know, we were trying to be jokes, trying to be the real story, but jokes as well. So, of course, this academic bloke comes and meets me and my mate James, Scouse James, who's much younger than me and therefore not as used to the sort of, not so cynic, you know, he hasn't got used to the, oh, blimey, these people go on sort of thing, you know. So this big academic bloke with this big bumbly beard sat down at this table and he went through the script like this. And at the start, there was a bloke called McCulloch in the story of Darwin, who was a ship's doctor. Doesn't really matter who he is, but at the start of the story, he's of some relevance. So the academic's going through the script and he went, right, now, first of all, first mistake, look at this here, page one, McCulloch. Look what you've done. Spelled him with one C. Should be two C's. Everybody knows that, I would have thought. And then down, I just thought, I'll just let him get on.
That's where you want to go. Yeah. I'm not one of your students, so.
Yeah, but you just put up, we've got to sit there, I'll just put up with it. And I can see mate James getting, yeah, what's going on? So and he goes, so then at the bottom of the page, we've gone and done it again here, look at this. McCulloch, you've done it again. Don't know what you were thinking of that day. Not concentrating, were you? Anyway, so after about four of these, my mate James says, well, look, it's for television, mate, you know, so it's absolutely essential we get this accurate, isn't it? And I thought, yes, because otherwise there's going to be loads of lead. Dear BBC, my enjoyment of the programme was completely ruined by the way in which Mr. Steele pronounced the word McCulloch as if it had one C, but everybody knows it's got two. You know? So, oh, God, this bloke's driving me nuts. And he was really pompous about it. And then eventually he said, look at this quote here. This quote here you've got from Darwin. Where on earth did you get that? That's preposterous. Where did you get that? And I thought, I mean, my confidence was so sapped now. But I thought, I know this is right. I've got to have to say it. I said, that's from your book, mate. And he went, And then McCulloch, you've gone and done it again. But of course, your confidence is so, you think, no, I must have got this wrong. And when we got back to the office, I sort of had the book there. And there it was, the quote he'd been moaning. And I sent him a little email saying, yes, just to confirm, page 109, whatever it was, fourth paragraph, there's the quote from your book. And he never, ever, he insisted he had his name took off the thing in the end because he had so many complaints about it.
I can't remember what, because I've read that book as well.
I wonder why people bloody, you've read that book?
Yeah, it's the Penguin. One of the Penguin biographies of Darwin, isn't it? It's him and someone else.
Yes,
two
a bloke
people,
called.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. Should we say his name? Yes. Yeah, well, Moore. Fine. Moore. It Moore. His name was. Fucker.
I mean, that's just, Moore with two M's, isn't it? Is that right? I can't remember. He's, well, no.
Something pronounced. Moore. Anyway, what a wanker.
Did you get any complaints sort of, from? I mean,
not
when
you, really? It, no, there was one or two. No, not really. I mean, there's one or two brilliant. I'd one that. One complaint that my shirt wasn't tucked in.
Did you read anything about, is it Charcot? Is that the correct pronunciation? The guy who's discovered hysteria?
Oh, right.
Because I was reading about him, and he's got, because of the fact that obviously only women, Josie, could become hysterical.
Because of the womb, yes. Of course.
Yeah.
And
or men, if they had, as he believed, flabby testicles.
Oh, I didn't know this.
Yeah, if men with flabby testicles can become hysterical.
That acts as a proto-womb.
Yeah, it's like a double womb. You don't know what you can. You just pop things in there if you want. If you've got things you want to hide, and also that women, because it became such a fashionable thing. So he'd put on big shows where he would go. Again, we've talked about the Elephant Man before. That kind of year when you were showing off. Look at this man. Oh, isn't he freaky?
Oh, I missed the Elephant Man talk.
No. Well, this was before we even turned the microphones on. But then, so he would do these shows, and he'd go, and now welcome one of the hysterical women, and a woman would come and go, oh, a man, and women, of course. Actually, the terrible thing is, it became such a fashion going, do you know what? I'd love to be on that stage being hysterical. So that when they stopped, he couldn't properly, even though he never believed in this, a lot of them would just come and go, I want to be on that stage. It'll be brilliant. So you go, right, next patient. Whoa, crazy. Have I passed the audition? Which I think is fantastic.
It's like the Crucible. You know, if you live in a very dull town, that is the most wonderful job you could have.
Yeah.
It's better than sweeping out the scullery, isn't it?
Brilliant. Yeah, but what it'd be like, did Andrew Lloyd Webber have a television programme where he picked the next hysterical woman with the readers' poll, viewers' poll?
I'm sorry, Hetty, you are not this week's hysterical woman.
Oh, God, it'd be brilliant, wouldn't it?
I'd watch.
Brilliant. And a little panel there.
There's a book, I can't remember who wrote the book, Hysteria. It's a really, really good. No, it's called Histories. H-Y-S-T. Anyway, it's good. Elaine Showalter, I think it's pronounced. Elaine McCulloch, sorry. No, it is Showalter.
McCulloch?
No, it's not McCulloch.
Let me tell you this. Right. I had a really... I need to predicate it with a different story just to sort of explain my position on this. With three different... Okay. Firstly, when I... in 2005, I was single and... I sort of was looking for love, and I had this idea that I wore this watch, and on the watch there was it was mended by blue electrical tape, and it was such a startling colour, and I really loved it. And I kind of had this thing that a guy would see the tape and he would know all these things about me. Like, he'd see it and he would think, oh, homemade stuff, like DIY, brilliant. And then I would look at him and he would look like Alan Bennett and Jarvis Cocker, and he'd be all brilliant, and it would be great. And I'd kind of given up hope on it because I never seemed to meet anyone and no one ever noticed it. And then I met a guy at a party, and the first thing he said to me was, I really like your watch. And I was like, oh my God. And he had the exact same watch, but he'd mended his with surgical tape, not electrical tape. And I thought, this is the most wonderful thing that's ever happened. If this
imagine living with him in a house, and we would always have two sets of tape for various different
for
possible accidents.
Exactly.
God,
what a dream.
There.
It's a dream.
It was Alan Bennett.
No, it was a young man. He was really cool. He was attractive. We had a lovely chat. And then after about 25 minutes of having this great chat, he started saying, have you ever noticed... what did he start? He started mentioning ley lines. And then he started mentioning underwater rivers, not underground rivers that might make sense or be true, underwater rivers and ley lines, and about how there's more... I know, which I think actually...
There is one basic flaw in the phrase underwater river.
See, but I think there is
some sort
of... It
depends on the way you believe in the layering of water, of course.
Like, I think
there
is some...
That's how homeopathy works, I think.
Oh, what? Yes, so a river is actually two rivers, the top half of the Thames and then the bottom half
of
the Thames.
Not all rivers, that would be ridiculous, so, I mean, there is current. Some of them.
I mean, there are currents, so I don't know if there are such things, but it definitely sounded fruity at the very least. And then he was talking about how, have you ever noticed about how the pound sign is like an infinity sign? That's how he started. The pound sign is like an infinity sign. And I thought, hello, what's going on here? But then it took me a little while because for the first couple of times I thought, no, it's fine because it's destiny, so it's going to be fine. And by the end I was like, no, you're mental. And then the conclusion of the story was, so these days I just go for muscles. A while back, last year, I had to get a lot of cabs to and from art centres. And for some reason, I got really interesting, strange cab drivers. Like, the first cab driver was this woman who was an artist who was painting in her cab when I got in it. And she kept turning around to show me the paintings. Like, what do you think of that? And I was a bit like, just look at the road! But they were very good. She was very nice. And
I always get cab drivers. I always get cab drivers who show me images of the homes that they're going to buy or that they've bought. So the other day I had one who's going, yeah, London's awful. It's absolutely awful. I've actually got a place in the Orkneys. It's a traffic's bad, isn't it? And he flipped up his thing and he goes, that's the place I got. It gets very windy. It's great. You just go up to the Orkneys and there's nothing to do there. So you can just sit in and watch television. And then I had another one who once pulled over on the Westway because he said, oh, I've got this amazing new fireplace that I've done. I've got a little house in Ireland. And he showed me a picture of a fireplace in Ireland. And because you're trapped at this point, there's no way out. You can only just stay in that lay-by wondering, you know, I mean, you can't comment on the fact that, to be honest, some of his tiling looked reasonably badly done around, you know, very close to the hearth. But I just went, that's amazing. That's fireplace is smashing.
Best fireplace I've ever
seen. W5. So I had one in Edinburgh. My favourite one in Edinburgh this year was because I think Edinburgh and Scottish cab drivers, I think there is something about the Scottish education system. I think it might be better where, you know, the conversations you often
they
have with
London cab
drivers.
They certainly do pass better, more liberal laws at the moment, don't they?
Yes. But there was where he went, were you up at the Edinburgh Festival last year? And I went, yes, I was. And he went, did you see the Robert Mapplethorpe exhibition? It was excellent. And I thought, I've never yet had a conversation with a London cab driver about any exhibitions of homoerotic art.
We had one last night.
Oh, you would with, I think you would with the mini cabs.
No, I was in a black cab with a man who started talking to us about the, went to see the crack at the Tate Modern yesterday. He started talking to us about the wife of, we went to the Mooners, is it Mooners?
Yeah.
Went to, about his wife. And he was like, oh, she's a very talented, she's a serious artist as well, she has a cement commissions. And I was like, this is great, this is so much better than you telling me that immigrants are wrong.
Yeah, but I don't think they're much, they're badly done by with their stereotype taxi drivers. I think they're I mean, they're as bad as they'd make it. I had a brilliant Rastafarian one that you would maybe appreciate with your take on this, because we got talking about the Bible and such matters. And we got outside my house, and one of them where the conversation carried on for a few minutes as we were sat outside the house. Rastafarian guy, and he was going on about the Bible, and he said, he's going, no, they're not truth, and what you see about the evolution, there are no evidence for this, and I'm mentioning the Bible, you know. And I said, well, look, you know, so we start getting this debate, and I said, look, they found all these bones and things and dinosaurs, and eventually he said this one sentence that I thought, I've just put my hand up and concede defeat. Most brilliant sentence I've ever heard from a taxi driver, because he said, listen, there ain't no mention in the Bible and no blood clad Stegosaurus.
Josie, you were telling us about your cab driver. We interrupted. I'm sorry.
It's all right. So I had this spate of getting really great cab drivers who were really cool and would sit and tell me, like, about the art. There was a guy who was chatting to me about, he asked me what I did, and I was like, oh, I'm a writer, because if you say you're a comedian, they tell you jokes, and often the jokes are really upsetting or whatever, and also I'm just not very funny, like, necessarily, whatever, so that's too critical.
You're not really selling yourself.
No, what
really
I mean is,
there.
Also, sometimes when you're in a cab, you're not necessarily best geared to be making people laugh. And then the third guy, within a month, was this guy who said, I'm an inventor. And I thought, hello, this is going to be a fun ride. He'll be like the other two. And he was absolutely crackers. He was like, oh, I'll show you my invention. And it was, do you know those things? They're like a wheel and part of it's concealed. And as you spin it round, you can see. So there's like, I've got one that's how to make different cocktails, and I've got one that's how to look in the sky at different times of years. And this one, he's like, oh, this one, you'll like it. You put it on your window, it aligns your chakras. And I just sat there staring at it, just thinking, I don't know how this could possibly mean anything or work. Like, he's like, oh, because it's obviously, so the sun comes in and you've got head and heart, so you can switch to head and then switch to Libra. And like, I was just so perplexed. And I was thinking, this is so sad because he's put loads of money into this prototype and there's no market for this except lunatics. This makes
no sense. Probably a fair market.
Well, yeah, to be fair. But then he started telling me about his big invention, which was the idea. He said, you're walking down the street, you're really thirsty, what can you possibly do? And I was like, you could go to the shop and buy some water, you could carry a flask of water with you, you could go to one of the fountains, there's a lot of fountains, you could go to a public toilet, use the fountain, you could... He's like, no, there's no way. If you're walking down the street and you're thirsty, there's nothing to do. Here's what they do. Here's what they do. Water vending machines. And I was like, okay, so they sell the water. Yes, raise money for the government, water vending machines on the street. And, and then he was like, what we do is we get super tankers and we ship water from all over the world to come into this country to sell in the vending machines. Do you know why? And I was like, why? And he's like, do you understand homeopathy? And I thought, I understand that homeopathy is a bit fruity. And he's like, listen, the water in Africa is influenced by the minerals that have been there. So it's completely different to the water from India, which will be influenced. So basically all the different waters will provide different healing solutions. You'll buy this water, super tankers. And then I thought, well, this isn't really a practicable idea. It's a bit ridiculous. And what you're saying about homeopathy is obviously not true, right? But I thought, well, and then he said, no, right, now listen to this. This is a dangerous idea. I've been blacklisted as an inventor because none of my adventures have worked. And I thought, oh God, I really don't want to be. So I was just like, okay, let me tell you something. Right, in 1992, I sent this letter out to all the world leaders. All the world leaders. I sent this letter out to 32 world leaders. 6 months later, Nelson Mandela was freed. That's how powerful this idea is. And that's why they're keeping this under wraps.
No,
my idea.
So...
And I was like,
it's so hard to know what
see,
to do.
See, I already
isn't it?
Now see all three of us. We've all been in separate cabs. We didn't even realise we were on the same road. And all three of us are in this same lay-by, staring at each other, terrified. I'm looking at a fireplace, trying to continue to compliment on it. You're trying to align your chakra, and you're trying to draw a picture of a blood clot stegosaurus. And all of us just looking out the back window, going, help me.
I brought this to show off. I brought this to show off. It's a trophy from Crystal Palace After School Girls Football Club. After school club most improved player, which is what they give you if you are so appalling there is no other trophy they can give you. And I thought I'd be really showing off, but compared to what you've brought in, it is
so is that trifle. Actually yours though, or you just bought
it's
it in a trophy shop?
Mine, I've got given it.
It's not just probably one of those things.
Has it got your name on it though?
Well, it's not that high tech a club. They didn't have the funds.
And what was it for
most improved
football?
Player for yeah after school girls football club when I was 12
for Crystal Palace.
I didn't play for Crystal Palace.
No, but
Crystal
Palace as a football team with Crystal Palace in the title.
It's Crystal Palace football team, which were in the Premier League for about a year, 3 years ago.
I know.
And I
was
got a trophy.
I'm an avid follower of Crystal
you
Palace.
Just don't remember yeah. when Josie was their striker, but
I'm the most improved player, so it's kind of important. So I thought it would be
sadly
really good
I could probably tell you every result from that season.
Yeah, well, let's not do that now because we're really running out of time. And
talked about what you've brought yet.
Mark, what have you brought with you?
Well, I have brought a copy of the first Clash album for a number of reasons. How do I sort of get through this quickly? I mean, first of all, everybody has their own little poignant albums if they listen to music at all, and this was definitely it. For me, you know, because it was the first Clash album, more than anything else, I think, from that era. Because being the age I was, you know, we were talking earlier about the post-war stability, and I think my generation was seen by my parents' generation as ruining all that stability. You know, they'd been through the 30s, they'd had the war, and now everything was fine, and things were getting better, and every year there's a new thing, a phone, a fridge, a you know, washing machine, whatever, no more chimney sweeps, central heating, everything's getting better. And then you come along, and in the middle of the 70s, you just ruin everything with your long hair and your all this. But anyway, this particular album, or copy, is signed by three of The Clash. But it's actually a really grim tale of how that happened, because about five and a bit years ago, I was asked, the Fire Brigade had a national dispute that some people might remember over pay, and I was asked to do a fundraising benefit at Acton Town Hall. There was going to be a fundraising benefit for the fire brigade strike or days of action, whatever it was called. And I said, yeah, I'll do that. And I know a few firefighting people and stuff. And so they said, yeah, loads of them know you, Mark. It'd be great, you know, we'd raise a lot of money. And about a fortnight later, after I'd agreed to do this, the woman who was organising it rang me up. And she said, we've got the most fantastic news. Guess who's going to be doing it as well? And of course, I thought it'd be, you know, another comic. But she said, Joe Strummer. He's going to come down with his band. And he's going to... And I said, well, that is brilliant. You know, thinking, well, I don't have to do it, but I'll come along to it. And she went, no, you've got to do it as well. I said, what? I can't. There's no point in me being on before Joe Strummer and his band. No, you've got to. You've got to. And I was just persuaded to do it through my own utter stupidity. So, of course, I turn up there. And as anyone, as you will both know, this is just wrong. You cannot have comedy and iconic punk bands from the 70s on the same bill. It just doesn't work. And, of course, it's all... And especially, so all the Strummer fans... Like thousands, there was about 500 Strummer fans there, plus another 500 people there for the campaign. But they were just as invigorated by the old Strummer thing. Nobody cared that I was there, which I'm not complaining about, because obviously. So there was about 1,000 people rammed in there, and the organisers going, "It's fantastic, isn't it? I mean, we could have sold twice as many tickets. It's so exciting." And there's just this sort of pre-Joe Strummer gig mood about it all. This ambient and the stage is absolutely packed with all the instruments and stuff, so I'm thinking I'm not even going to have any room here to, if I manage to walk on without just doing 15 grand's worth of fucking damage, I'll have done well. Absolutely rammed, and there's sort of there's a DJ playing all sort of Prince Buster and stuff like that before I'm on, and everyone's excited except me, because I'm just utterly distraught, thinking, what am I going to do? And I've written somewhere, actually, I thought every moment that went by there was a new thing that made it impossible to do a comedy gig. I thought in a minute someone will say, oh, we've got some horses to gallop around while you're on. It was just everything.
Don't forget free glue given away in 5 minutes. Yeah, oh, no.
Yeah, everything.
Everything.
There's a bouncy castle on the stage with you and you'll be under it. It's just everything wrong. And, of course, I wandered out there, feedback, screeching, people sort of thinking, oh, is the band on? Because the DJ stopped, loads of people coming in. What is it? Everybody talking. Utter disaster. And there's maybe about 100 people who were sort of knew me at the front looking up, but with the sort of way that you would look when you're seven and you go to the zoo and you think, what is that creature? That sort of look. And it 900 people behind them all chatting and drinking and calling to their mates, and I try to do a couple of jokes about firemen or something, and it's a disaster. And I've been on about a minute, an awful minute, and then this bloke went, fuck off, just like that. And he was a firefighter in uniform. So I did a little bit about, like, oh, is that your normal greeting for the way that you sort of welcome people who come to support you? Do that on picket lines. I mean, that works when someone comes up and says, oh, we've had a little collection, and we thought, fuck off, you know. And I start going into a little routine in my own world about if this was the way movements had been built over the years, Martin Luther King, if instead of saying I had a dream, well, you've all come here now, you can fuck off. And I was amusing myself, but nobody else. And then the bloke went, fuck off again. And I said, do you know what, I'm going to change what I think you ought to change your demands. I think it ought to be 30 grand for firefighters, except for you, who has to work for the rest of your life 18 hours a day for fuck all in the most fucking blazing hot fires, and you don't even have to have a pole, you have to jump off the roof. So anyway, fuck. And then at this point, right, some bloke in the who was doing the sound, he's turned me sound off, so now I've got, so then people, whee, and I'm stood there with that. And then the lighting man turned the lights off, and then there's all just feedback, and I just had to leave. And it was the most utterly shit miserable 2 minutes on stage. And then a few minutes went by, Strummer comes on, the place goes mental, absolutely mental. Everybody's diving about, people are grabbing it. Mark, it's fantastic, isn't it? And there was and then Mick Jones, the guitarist with the Clash, who fell out with Strummer in the 80s and for 15 years hadn't played with Strummer after this acrimonious fight, turned up at the gig, got up on stage, utterly magical moment. And I just sat there thinking, I am so miserable. Everybody else was delirious, and I thought, this is just, I'm just miserable. And at the end of it all, I thought, well, I get to meet Strummer, my hero. I get to meet him, so at least I can do that. And I took this album along to get him to sign it. And I, so at the end of it all, I went backstage, or tried to, and there's a bloke there in front of the dressing room. I said, I'm just going back to get me stuff. And he went, who the fuck are you? I said, I'm Mark Steele, I was on earlier on. Who the fuck are you? And so I had about 5 minutes to convince him that I should be able to go and get my own stuff back. And then while I was there, so now my self-esteem is lower than it's been at any time since I was about 3 minutes old. And I've walked in there, and the strummer in there is in his dressing room, and he's in his underpants, and Mick Jones, he's just getting changed, and there's some of his fans there. And I sort of went, Joe's not still, I don't know if it was on, but I really fat, I was 17 with a career opportunity. But when you first started there, and he went, what? I said, oh no, just you signed me, just put, and I gave him the record, and as I gave him the record itself, which is here, fell out of the cover, and it sort of rolled in a big circle and landed at the feet of Mick Jones, and with a sort of sort of like a coin. And they both looked at me thinking, who is this wanker? And Mick Jones just picked it up and went, careful.
And what's lovely is actually, it's not, they haven't actually put their names. All they've written in big felt tip is, who the fuck are you, on that. So, well, that the sweariest one we've done yet, Mark. You've had a lot of rage. That is also explains why Mark is now pretty much semi-professional arsonist. A lot of factories and orphanages have gone up recently.
So funny, when I came in a little bit late and I looked at this and I thought, oh, that's amazing. He's probably been hanging out with Joe Strummer. They're probably, the story's probably going to be about how him and Joe Strummer were...
Oh. Anyway, that is the that's the end of the podcast. Thank you very much for listening. As Josie Long obviously joined us, and Mark Steele, and it was produced by Helen and Adrian. Thank you.